Welcome, I'm Mark Hertzgard. This is Your Call, the Friday Media Roundtable. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. She's in North Dakota covering the Standing Rock pipeline protests. Today's show begins in Colombia, the South American nation where a brutal civil war that lasted 52 years appeared to be ending last month when the government reached a peace agreement with the rebel group FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Force of Colombia. But a national referendum narrowly rejected the agreement, shocking local and international observers alike. Then, this morning, a key architect of the deal, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, won the Nobel Peace Prize. We'll dig into what happened, what lies ahead, and what role the media played. We'll also be getting ready for Sunday night's presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. We focus on economics and taxes and how well the media has explained these crucial issues. The New York Times recently published a leaked copy of Trump's 1995 tax returns. We'll talk to perhaps the world's leading expert on Donald Trump's business dealings for insights into how Trump apparently managed to owe no federal taxes for 18 years. And since this is the Friday Media Roundtable, I'm going to break with tradition here and give a quick shout out to one of the great journalists who we lost 10 years ago today, October 7th, 2006, Anna Politkovskaya. I don't think I'm pronouncing that quite correctly, but she was one of the bravest and certainly one of the most capable investigative reporters on earth. She was shot to death in her Moscow apartment 10 years ago today, October 7, 2006. She had done a lot of deep investigative reporting that powerful people did not want known. 10 years ago today, Anna Politkovskaya. Rest in peace. Now, let me introduce our distinguished group of experts to talk about Colombia and taxes. First, on the Colombia side of the story, Roque Plana. He's a national reporter at the Huffington Post, where he covers Latino politics and Latin American affairs. He's also the co-founder of the Latin America News Dispatch. Roque Plana, welcome to Your Call.
Thanks for having me.
Very good. And David K. Johnston, many times been on this show. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of numerous books, most recently the book The Making of Donald Trump. He's investigated Donald Trump for nearly three decades, and he's the man you want to be listening to if you're interested in Donald Trump's business dealings and taxes. Welcome, David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you, Mark, for that nice introduction. Glad to be here.
Very good. And as we always do here on the Friday Media Roundtable, we're going to start, before we dig into the issues, asking each of you to give a shout-out to one piece of journalism that you had especially high regard for this week. Roque Plana with the Huffington Post. Could you begin, please?
Sure. This is actually one that I listened to because I've been spending a lot of time walking my dog and getting my news that way. But it's from This American Life, from the episode Deep End of the Pool. And it tells a story about this real estate attorney who gets a call to sort of do his duty as a public defender and takes this case that he thinks is going to, you know, is an obviously guilty man accused of burglary. And there's DNA evidence that's linking him to it. But, you know, he sort of becomes convinced that the guy didn't do it and ends up trying to take the case to trial, which never happens in this district. And I thought it was just this really nice sort of way of framing the problems with the criminal justice system because, you know, we have a criminal justice system that often acts sort of like an autoimmune disease, you know, that is sort of ruining people's lives that people, you know, when they come into contact with it. And it's sort of a sad story and one that you hear a lot, but this one took it in sort of a different approach, and it seemed a little bit more hopeful to see someone challenge the system and actually strike a win.
So that was from This American Life, and of course we'll link to that. David K. Johnston, what was the piece that stood out to you this week?
Well, if you are a news junkie, it makes sense to learn to read bylines, because as Cy Hirsch says, if you pick up the New York Times, you can read the greatest journalism human beings have ever produced. Move over one column, pure junk. And I found a new byline today. Emily Badger, like the animal, B-A-D-G-E-R. She has a news analysis called We're All a Little Biased, Even If We Don't Know It. It's about Mike Pence's comments in the vice presidential debate and what the best scientific knowledge to this point tells us about bias, its uses, because it does have uses, and its abuses. And it's a very sophisticated piece. I'm sure that people can pick lint off it, as the late Wally Turner, the San Francisco bureau chief for the New York Times, used to say. But I thought it indicated a very sophisticated journalist, and I thought it was a piece important for all of us to read to understand implicit bias.
Implicit bias. Boy, that is a very pregnant topic for the news media covering
politics. It sure
is.
And even if you try hard to stop and question yourself, it's still there. But she also points out that there are some reasons that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very good piece.
So let's have a look at that. And I want to give a shout-out to a piece, frankly, David, that you wrote this piece this week. It was your piece in the Daily Beast that basically breaks down. We'll get into this in the second half of the show, but
sure.
Basically breaks down how Trump did what he did. And I want to recommend that to everybody, but we'll be getting to that in the second half of the show. We're going to start here with Colombia, which, you know, we planned the show a few days ago, not knowing, of course, that this morning was going to bring the news that the Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the president of Colombia, who played a big role in reaching this peace agreement, President Juan Manuel Santos. And kind of a surprise, but Roque Plana, can you talk to us a little bit about that? Is the Nobel Peace Prize, in your view as somebody who's covered this, is it warranted in his case? And what is the likely impact it's going to have on the prospects for peace going forward?
Certainly whether or not it's warranted, I think, is up for, you know, other people, particularly Colombians, to decide. But I think what they were trying to do here was to give Santos that extra push of international credibility that maybe might help get everyone to the table and continue these peace talks that, you know, have a lot of uncertainty surrounding them since the referendum that Santos had proposed didn't pass on Sunday. I think right now what's going on is you have Álvaro Uribe, who led the most forceful part of the military campaign to defeat the FARC, sort of taking control of what the negotiations are going to look like since Sunday, because he was one of the leaders of the campaign against the referendum. And if you look on Twitter, you'll see a sort of backhanded compliment that he sent to Santos. Basically, Uribe communicates a lot through Twitter, and he says something to the effect, I don't have it in front of me, but something to the effect of congratulations on the Nobel Peace Prize. I hope that it helps you renegotiate this deal that's bad for Colombia or something
right.
like that.
So
that's hurtful to Colombia.
Let's take one step back for some of our listeners who may not have been following the news out of Colombia quite so carefully. This referendum that occurred last Sunday, where voters across Colombia went to the polls to vote basically up or down on the peace deal. This was a peace deal that the government had reached with FARC, the rebel group, after 52 years of civil war. Everybody, as far as I can tell, expected the voters to give a thumbs up to this deal, and in the end, they didn't. It was very, very close. I think it was 50.2% to 49.8%. But, Roque Plana, can you tell us what was, did the media just get this wrong in terms of the expectation that this referendum was going to pass, or what?
Sure. No, well, there was a couple things going on there. I don't think, I think people in the international media surely are very sympathetic to the efforts at peace. I think that's, so maybe there was a little bit of that playing in there, but I think the first
hopeful thinking.
Hello?
Was it wishful thinking? Is that what you're saying?
Was it a little bit of wishful thinking? Perhaps that played into it, but the absolute main thing was that Colombian polling was just simply bad. This was a disastrous day for pollsters because all the predictions were wrong, and they were wrong not by a little bit, but by a lot and uniformly. So I think there's a lot of thinking going on in Colombia about whether or not, you know, the institutions that they've built for polling work well, and whether or not, you know, that's something that needs to be looked at more skeptically in the future. Another thing that happened was that there was, you know, the hurricane off the Caribbean coast that caused a lot of people not to be able to go vote. I think, you know, it's hard to know how much of an impact that it had an impact, certainly. Would it have tipped the scales? Not quite sure. Definitely, though, the heightened expectations that it were going to pass was fed in large part by the polling.
I think only 38% of the eligible voters actually voted, and you mentioned that the hurricane played a role, especially up in the northern coastal regions of Colombia, but Can the hurricane really explain that low of a turnout?
No, you know, and I wish I had a better explanation for that, too. You know, I have a lot of Colombian friends here who are entitled to vote and didn't cast a ballot, and I found it shocking because a lot of them were really upset with the outcome. So certainly for everyone listening, I hope that, you know, they take what happened in Colombia to heart and don't do the same on November 7th or November 8th or whatever election day is.
Oh, November 8th in this country, yeah. Well, we're going to be talking about that shortly. And let me just quickly say, of course, while we're having this conversation, we would like all of you to join the conversation. So you can call in at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio or leave a comment at www.yourcallradio.org. And one more thing before I bring in you, David K. Johnston. The you mentioned the former president, Alvaro Uribe, who has been an opponent to this peace deal. Uribe, obviously a right-wing candidate. Does it break down quite so simply that the right wing is against this peace deal and the left in Colombia is in favor of it, or is it a little more complicated than that?
It's certainly more complicated because Santos himself is a conservative, right? I think you could have, maybe if you were to talk about a conservative and a hardline element, it might make more sense. But it's really hard to underemphasize how much there is a really quite strong stigma against the FARC. And the No campaign, you know, the campaign manager for the people who quashed the referendum, you know, the guy who was leading it gave this interview to La Republica in Colombia that caused all this controversy yesterday, because basically what he was saying in there was that they decided very early on in the campaign that they weren't going to focus on the details, that they were simply going to try to make everyone very angry, that they were, and they were going to tilt even toward, you know, some things that were very, like their strategy on the East Coast was just to say that the deal was going to turn the country into Venezuela, which is fundamentally dishonest, right? And, you know, for everybody else, they were going to focus very hard on impunity, even though that's been one of the criticisms of Alvaro Uribe himself. You know, I mean, he presided over very severe human rights abuses and abuses in the intelligence service when he was president from 2002 to 2008, or to 2010. So, you know, there was also that element. They were very successful at getting people very riled up, regardless of political spectrum.
But that's one of the tricky bits about this agreement, isn't it? Because, yes, there were terrible human rights abuses on the part of the government, but also terrible human rights abuses on the part of the FARC, no?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I think it's very hard for people to forgive that and to sort of make those concessions that are really necessary if they want to get the FARC demobilized. So we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. David K. Johnston, you have been a reporter and worked many years at the New York Times. Just curious, I know you don't cover Colombia and Latin American issues, but I reckon that you've sat in editorial meetings where, you know, you're talking about how do stories like this play on the front page. Is it surprising to you that the New York Times ended up being so wrong about what was going to happen on this referendum in Colombia?
Well, I think the referendum was a big surprise to a lot of people. And I think the Times' effort was to alert people to what was happening. And by the way, about the Nobel Prize, it seems to me if you look at Obama's prize, Shimon Peres's, this prize to the Colombian president, and a lot of others, the Nobel Committee is looking for people who are trying to bring about peace. Doesn't mean they're going to succeed, but they made really noble, to make a pun, efforts.
That is certainly true, as one thinks back to some of the people who have won the Nobel Peace Prize over the years. We've got a call here from Homer in San Jose. Welcome to your call.
Okay, hi. My take on this is that your guess is somewhat wrong on the conclusion of why the referendum did not pass in Colombia. My wife is Colombian, and all the way up to the referendum, I could hear a lot of Colombians actually want peace, but they didn't want it at the price that the government had negotiated for. So it wasn't really because of hurricanes or lack of electorate. It was because the fundamental disagreement on the terms of the referendum that did not pass.
Rookie Plana?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I just want to clarify there that I don't think that we're in fundamental disagreement there. I think when I say that the polling was bad, I think what it precisely what it was doing was underestimating the number of people who were going to vote no and overestimating turnout and ultimately overestimating the yes vote. So I don't think that we're really in disagreement there. And it is important to emphasize one thing that you're saying, which is that the rejection of the peace deal doesn't mean that Colombia is going back to war. It means they're renegotiating the peace. So it's a question now of what that's going to look like. And, you know, like I said before, I think for a lot of people, it's going to hinge on what kind of concessions they're willing to give, where they're willing to give the FARC.
Are the concessions only going to be coming from one direction?
Well, what's going to happen now is that the Santos administration is going to have to meet with the leaders of the No campaign that's been going on all week in Bogota. They're going to have to come to agreements between them and then propose that to the FARC in Havana and see what they can, you know, what kind of agreement they can hash out. And if it's going to be satisfactory to everyone, I don't know whether that's going to imply another referendum, a whole other peace agreement. It sounds like they need to rework substantial portions of a very large and complex agreement addressing issues of, you know, whether or not the FARC can participate in political life and who, whether or not people are going to face or what kind of legal repercussions they're going to face for things that went on in the war. So there's a whole lot of things that need to get aired out and discussed and then renegotiated. It's really unclear at this point what will happen.
And that needs to happen quickly because the ceasefire, I believe, expires October 31st. We have another call now from Orion in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a comment that I believe it could be possible that the vote was tampered with. All we have to do is look at our own history with the Bush family involved in two elections where, in the first case, the Bushes in Florida and the tampering with the chats and the Supreme Court nominations and the unwillingness to count the votes for the first Bush election and then the second Bush election where one out of four or five votes flipped from Democrat to Republican. This is a very close and contested battle. I'm just wondering if the forces that are opposed to change and peace may have used their money and their power to change the outcome of this vote at all.
Roque Plana, was there vote tampering in the Colombia referendum on the peace deal?
I certainly haven't seen that there's a lot of, and thanks for the question, I certainly haven't seen that there's a lot of allegations to that effect. And, I mean, unless something huge were to come out very shortly, I think what's most important is that the government has already sort of recognized that the results is valid. So I think that the renegotiation process is just gonna keep moving forward for now.
Mm-hmm. And one more question. You know, this is the Friday Media Roundtable, so we'd like to talk a little bit about the media coverage. Did you follow the media coverage in Colombia? Did they do a decent job of making clear the referenda conditions to the electorate? And do you have any commentary on how the U.S. media covered the Colombia referendum?
I mean, sure, what I didn't do right from here was to watch Colombian television, which is a whole different animal, Colombian radio. Most people in Colombia get their news on radio. So I think you might have a very different impression if you were following those media more closely. And I understand that Uribe and the No campaign had quite a bit more influence in television and radio. Now, having said that, Colombia has some of the most amazing journalistic institutions that you could hope for in Latin America, and they do it under very, very extreme conditions of violence and threats. So certainly, you know, reporting from Jesse Vacia, Semana, you know, you have all kind of reporters, including investigative reporters, doing really great work down there. And so I think that, you know, the lines were very clear, I felt, you know, I mean, the at least what was coming out in the print press. What seems that the No campaign was trying very hard to do, and of course they accused the Yes campaign of trying to do it too, was to
oversimplify some of these issues, like to say that because people who are demobilized out of the FARC can run for election, they're going to turn the country into Venezuela. I mean, that's just, there's not any, I think it's very hard to imagine a Colombia in which the FARC can field even a small minority, let alone a majority control of the electoral, of Congress or the presidency. As far as the U.S. media, I think probably the most interesting thing to think about moving forward is, you know, the implications for what Plan Colombia meant to the Colombian government. There was a multi-billion-dollar, but about an $8 billion security package that's largely credited with helping beat back the FARC. And the thing that is interesting about that is that because we have such extreme violence with gangs and so forth, and drug trafficking in Central America, and that's causing the main source of migration right now, or one of the largest sources of migration in the United States, of undocumented folk crossing the border. You know, do we need some kind of similar Plan Colombia inspired program for Central America, that we already do have some sort of aid packages? And I think, you know, the sort of suggestion that that is necessary really kind of papers over how violent this scorched earth campaign that the Colombian government waged against the FARC was. You know, the problems that Central America and the Colombia face aren't ones that you can only, you know, military spend your way out of. They have very significant problems with land ownership, with poverty, with inequality that need to be addressed if you're going to see a long-term change.
Mm-hmm. David K. Johnston, very quickly before we go to break here, I think you, like me, you're not on the Colombia beat, and yet this is a
right.
country very important to many aspects of U.S. policy, including the $9 billion that we taxpayers sent down there under Plan Colombia. Do you feel, as I guess as a colleague and a consumer of the news, that you have been adequately informed about what's been going on in Colombia?
No, not at all. And I think that's a commercial decision about, you have limited and now very limited resources, even at the biggest news organizations, about where to put them. But what's going on in Colombia, the role of the narcotics business, the history that remains from the colonial era, and the inequality, particularly in land ownership, those are issues that do have effects here in the United States, but the coverage we get is sort of spotty, and unfortunately, too much of it consists of what Western diplomats in Colombia tell Western reporters. And the other caller is quite right. The few times I have dug into see news in Colombia, I'm struck by the sophistication and the vigor of it. And when I have been interviewed on Colombian radio about issues here in America, I've always been impressed that the radio hosts were very well informed and asked smart, concise, well-honed questions.
Very good. That's David K. Johnston. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and the author most recently of The Making of Donald Trump. He'll be staying with us for the second half of the show. And we'll say farewell and thank you very much to our other guest, Roque Plana. He's a national reporter at the Huffington Post, where he covers Latino politics and Latin America affairs. He also is the co-founder of Latin America News Dispatch. Roque Plana, thank you so much for being here on Your Call.
Thank you so much. Great talking to you.
You bet. And we'll be back after a short break here. We'll be bringing in Jim Tankersley of The Washington Post to talk about taxes and the economy in the 2016 presidential election. Stay with us.
Listening to Your Call on local public radio, KALW. If your KALW membership is near its renewal date, you may have just received a letter from us asking you to keep supporting local public radio. You can help us save on mailing costs by renewing today. Use the handy return envelope or go to our website, kalw.org, and click donate. And thank you for your continued support.
Welcome back to the Friday Media Roundtable on Your Call Radio. I'm Mark Hertzgard. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar this week, this Friday, rather. She's in North Dakota covering the Standing Rock Pipeline protest. You'll be hearing reports from Rose coming up on that very important breaking story. But now to the second topic of our show today, the economy and taxes and the 2016 presidential campaign. I bet you think we're going to talk about Donald Trump. Well, yes, we are. How can you avoid it? This week, the New York Times had a document leaked to them that they published and verified and published. It was part of Donald Trump's 1995 tax returns, and the New York Times story showed that Donald Trump in 1995 declared $916 million in losses. That's almost $1 billion. And as a result, he put himself into the position of apparently not having to pay federal income taxes for 18 years. When the general issue, the general question of Trump's taxes came up in the first presidential debate, and Hillary Clinton made this point, accusing him of not paying enough taxes, Mr. Trump replied, "That makes me smart," unquote, because he used the existing tax loopholes. We're going to talk about that with David K. Johnston, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and the author of the book The Making of Donald Trump. There is nobody I'm aware of on this green earth that knows more about Donald Trump's business dealings than David K. Johnston. Thank you, David, for staying with us. But also joining us is Jim Tankersley. He covers economic policy for The Washington Post, and he had a very interesting piece after the first debate in which he kind of cut against the grain and said that that Donald Trump actually won the argument on the economy and jobs. And I want to start with that, but first let me welcome Jim Tankersley from The Washington Post, the economics correspondent at The Washington Post. Thank you for joining us here at Your Call, the Friday Media Roundtable. Jim Tankersley, are you there with us?
I'm here, yes. Thanks for having me so much.
Okay, did you hear my question?
I did not hear the question. Please
okay.
Fire away.
I'll repeat it. I said that you had a very interesting piece right after the first presidential debate in which you kind of cut against the grain of a lot of the commentary and said that Donald Trump won the most important argument of the night, which was on jobs and the economy, and that he basically bested Hillary Clinton in those first few minutes of the debate. Can you kind of recount that for us again, and do you still stand by that position?
I do, and I want to be really clear that I'm talking about a very specific exchange that the two of them had, and it's an issue on which they actually disagree on a matter of scale, but not on the direction of policy. The issue is trade, and Donald Trump started off with a forceful case to working-class voters that by changing trade policies, he was going to create better, you know, job creation in America, and he really spoke to the anxieties of particularly blue-collar workers who have felt left behind by globalization and the economy. It's been one of the stories of this election. Obviously, it's been an abiding story of the American economy now for the entire century that we're in. But Trump really was more forceful and more simple in his rhetoric on the trade argument, and he put Hillary Clinton on the defensive to a point where Hillary Clinton, a candidate who has also been very critical of trade deals in this campaign, found herself defending NAFTA, which her husband brought into law. And so I thought that in that moment, he was making the more forceful case to the working class that he had policies to create jobs. Now, it's worth going further in this discussion, I think, and maybe we could talk a bit more later about whether he will be able to deliver what he's promising. But in speaking the language of people who feel left behind of the economy in that particular exchange, I thought Trump was stronger.
Let's, in fact, dig a little bit deeper there and with an eye towards Sunday night's debate between these two candidates. If you were there on the stage and you wanted to sort of make clear beyond the rhetoric and the presentation of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton what their actual policies are going to be in that regard, what would be the question that you would try and hone in on with both candidates? Jim first.
I mean, you know, there are lots of questions that I want to ask the candidates, but I think that the simplest is to say, is to really ask both of them, what is in your policies for a typical American worker. Tell us concretely how someone who is still struggling in this economy today, who doesn't have a job or who's not working as much as they want or hasn't had as much of a raise as they would like in the last few years, what specifically would your plans do? And then you need very sharp follow-ups. When Donald Trump says his plans are going to bring back millions of jobs, the factories are going to reopen that were pushed over to China, it's worth asking him, well, how? How is that going to happen? There have been lots of economists who've been critical who have said that the opposite would happen, that if you levy tariffs on, which is his proposal, on our trading partners, that could actually reduce growth and kill more jobs. I think it's getting into those details after the first question when you ask them to really spell out how their plans would affect people that I would be most interested in.
David K. Johnston, if you were up on that stage Sunday night and able to question Hillary Clinton, but especially Donald Trump, since Trump is the guy you've done the most reporting on, how would you try and focus not just on the economy, but particularly on this whole tax question, which you've done so much of the reporting on?
Well, if I can just step back to the trade issue. As sure. A political matter, Jim is exactly right. Donald presented the argument that the blue-collar workers in America whose jobs were taken away and have made the rural poor of China and Vietnam and other countries better off have gotten nothing in return. Other countries in globalization have had steps to mitigate the damage to these workers, and we have some infinitesimally tiny programs here. As you know from my trilogy about the economy, Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and the Fine Print, I've shown that government policies are devastating the bottom 90%, especially the bottom 50% of Americans. But a trade war would, in fact, economic theory tells us and experience from the past tells us, not achieve those goals. So I would ask Trump, who would need Congress to do these things, the president can't do them, Congress has to do them, to spell out exactly what he would do and what would he do about all of the high-tech jobs and the things we do export and do pretty well at to those jobs. You know, we do pretty well exporting high-level services to the rest of the world. And I'm confident that Trump couldn't answer with any sophistication. If you'll notice, he always talks in vagaries and does not have any understanding of the core of how the economy works.
Let's also talk about taxes here, because I think both of these candidates, although they sound different, they neither one of them is really going to change the tax rates in terms of the way that they tend to favor the 1%, are they?
No, and I've come to the conclusion after years of working on this that we need an entirely new tax code. So my next book is tentatively titled The Prosperity Tax, an entirely new tax code for the 21st century economy. We actually have a very good tax system for 1960, and we don't live in that economy anymore, and the economy we have cuts against the economic order. It heavily taxes manufacturing. That's why one of the many reasons manufacturing has gone offshore. The biggest reason has been labor arbitrage, lower wages. But the tax system that we have cannot work in the 21st century economy. So for the fourth time in our history, we need a whole new tax system. What the candidates are proposing are little edges here. Now, the Tax Foundation said Trump's original plan, with all of its vagaries, would increase the federal debt by at least $10 trillion. That's a conservative anti-tax group, the Tax Foundation. The Tax Policy Center, which has a very good track record of being accurate in its computer modeling, had an even higher number. The Tax Foundation has since cut its estimate back to around $4 billion, but most of Donald Trump's proposals would benefit the already very rich, and by that I don't mean the 1%. Half of the 1% make $400,000 to $600,000 in round numbers and get almost all of their income from work. It's the people whose incomes derive from capital directly or indirectly that are in the top tenth of 1%, $2 million and above. Trump's plan would do this. He says he's going to increase child care tax benefits. Well, he would give an unlimited tax break to people wealthy enough to have three nannies who fly the kids around first class to the various mansions people own. Really? Do we need that? Do we need that kind of subsidy? When we have working people who in many cases work so that they stay in the workforce and don't get shut out, but who really are taking home virtually nothing after they pay for childcare. And what's the price we pay for that instead of having, as every other modern country does, a policy that says we will invest in children, we will actually pay you to stay home while your child is very small so they develop to their full potential as adults, so we're better off and richer as a country in the future?
Jim Tankersley, let me bring you in here in a second, but first let me remind our listeners we'd love to involve you as well. So please give us a call if you've got a question or a comment. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or you can leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org. Join the conversation here. We've got about 15 minutes left. Jim Tankersley, you write for The Washington Post. David K. Johnson, a longtime print reporter. I've spent most of my life doing print. And yet, it is really television that tends to drive modern presidential campaigns. I want to ask you, how much time do you spend watching our television colleagues, and how do you think they have done in terms of explaining the economic and tax policies of the two candidates, main candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
I will confess that I do not have a lot of time during my day to watch cable news. I've certainly watched all of the televised coverage of the debates. I watch Washington Week on PBS on Fridays, and you know they get very deep into the issues. And I read a lot of the things that the TV stations put out in online content. I just don't have time to watch. I will say this, though. I mean, I think that increasingly in this election, what we've seen is an amplification process where TV and social media and clicky internet stories are driving each other. And in that grand mix of things, it is certainly true that the various scandals and controversies and the polls have received far and away the most attention, and policy issues, economic policy issues in particular, seem to, even by our standards of sports, politics of sports, even by that standard, the issues have gotten short shrift this time, and I'm biased because I make my living writing about the issues, and it feels lonely some days doing that. But I also really think that this has just been a campaign that, in the sort of zeitgeist of social media and TV, has been dominated by just one controversy after another, and that has taken up a lot of the oxygen that should have gone to issue coverage.
And yet a lot of people have said that 2016 essentially is a campaign about the economy. That's the thrust of Donald Trump's approach, and Hillary Clinton as well, saying, you know, I'm for you, and we've got to deal with the making this a fair economy again. And whichever way you come down on the issues, you would think that the media should be doing better on that, don't you think?
I mean, obviously, I'm biased toward issues coverage, so I would agree with that. I would say, though, I mean, as much as I would like to believe this is an election entirely about the economy, I think we're learning that it's not. I think there's a lot of evidence that there are big other forces happening right now, some of which are economic and some of which aren't. This is an election about culture, about race, about national security fears, about terrorism, and in particular, I think, about sort of identity politics at a variety of levels. So those are hard things to get into, even for people who deal in data and issues most of the time. And the fact that they're not being really discussed outside of just the realms of whether, you know, who's arguing with whom or whatever on the campaign trail is frustrating.
That's Jim Tankersley. He covers economic policy for The Washington Post. David K. Johnson, I want to ask you a question. You were on this show, I don't know, earlier this year, I think, and when Trump was beginning to do well in the Republican primaries. And at that point, you had done a piece that I think was headlined something like 19 questions that reporters should be asking Donald Trump about his business dealings. And that grew out of all of your reporting on Trump over the years. I think that was back in February. Now we're here in October. How would you evaluate how the media has kind of taken, the rest of the media, I should say, has taken up your implicit challenge to them in that period of time?
Well, the 21 questions, which I wrote in July of last year, only two of them have ever been asked, one by Ted Cruz and one by Marco Rubio. My peers and Tankersley's peers have done a terrible job in covering the issues here. Many Trump supporters seem unaware of the fact that Donald Trump says wages are too high. They think he is going to rescue them from this economic terror that a lot of them live in. But Donald Trump's history shows that he was involved in an 18-year struggle to not fully pay illegal immigrants $4 an hour. I mean, think about that. If you're willing to fight for 18 years to not pay people $4 an hour, you're no champion of working people. And at the end of the day, by the way, they didn't get their full money. And how much they got, we don't know, because Trump, as he does with the many, many lawsuits he settles, despite his claim he never settles, always settles on terms that the terms are confidential and sealed by the court. This is an election, Tankersley is exactly right, this is an election that's been about race. Donald Trump began his campaign with a racist diatribe to huge applause by what I report in my book were paid actors, which tells you what a fraud his campaign began with. And the real policy issues here, they're not being discussed in any meaningful, serious way. This is being covered as a personality contest. Do you like him? Do you like Hillary? And Trump making these vague promises but showing no capacity to deliver on them. And the question I would love to ask Donald Trump is, can you specify where in the Constitution the president's job is described and tell us what the duties, limitations, and powers are on the executive? And I'm confident he couldn't answer that.
I want to take us back, since this is a show on the economy, to that critical point you just made, David K. Johnson, about Trump having said on the record that wages are too high in this country. And I want to ask both of you, why is it that's well known, you know, it's documented, why is it that that basic fact has not gotten through? How much of that is the responsibility of us in the media to get a straightforward representation of a candidate's views across, and why has that not happened? Jim Tankersley.
Well, with Donald Trump, I think the big reason why things like that don't happen is that he takes multiple positions, oftentimes opposing positions on economic issues. This is one of them. Today, jobs report comes out today. It shows wage growth is up about 2.5% year over year, which is above the inflation rate. Not great, but above the inflation rate by at least a point. And Donald Trump puts out a statement saying that it's not enough, that it's barely keeping up with inflation, wages are too low, essentially. In the same way, Donald Trump has both said that he would take advantage of the low interest rates in the economy right now to borrow money and spend it on infrastructure because he's the king of debt, but also told the Washington Post editorial board earlier this year that he wanted to pay off the entire national debt in 8 years. Like, there's no way both those things can be true, just in the same way there's no way that wages can be too low in the economy and too high.
So how does that not come across, though, from the in the coverage? Because your answer seems to imply that it is entirely a matter of the candidate, that Trump is kind of running circles around the media.
I think Donald Trump, there's been lots of theories about this, but I think Trump, he's able to hold multiple positions that shift over time, in part because he has so many of them. I mean, these are things that if Mitt Romney had switched positions on the debt, he would have been called a flip-flopper, or John Kerry. I mean, we have good examples in recent history of the flip-flopper charge being damaging and sticking, and we just haven't seen that with Donald Trump, in part because his policy positions seem to be less interesting to most media coverage directors, or whatever you want to call them, editors, producers, than his, you know, personal controversies or the controversies of the campaign.
David K. Johnston, how do you look at this?
Well, Donald Trump is great television. And you know, everybody slows down and rubbernecks when there's an auto accident. Donald Trump is a auto wreck with dancing girls and fireworks. And people just can't turn away. And TV executives, including Les Moonves, the head of CBS, and Roger Ailes, until he was fired for sexual harassment, have said that they found that if they're critical of Trump, or they actually go into his contradictions, or more importantly, utter lack of actual policy, people turn off their channels. So that has affected television in a way that it hasn't affected print, but it's television where most people get their news. And the Trump, you have to keep in mind, Trump is a master salesman. I mean, he's a really great salesman. He's gotten so many people to buy into things that turned out to be disasters for them but made him rich. So I'm not surprised that he has been able, through polishing his shtick over many years and with his television show and other appearances, to figure out the weaknesses of television media. You know, when Trump was banning news organizations from his campaign events, he banned the Daily Beast, whom I write for on contract, the Washington Post, which has done some superb reporting and which I've helped them a bit with some documents, and he did never once shut off anybody in TV. Not once.
Well, I can't help but ask then about this little battle within Fox News this week where I guess there's a conflict between Megyn Kelly and Sean Hannity about Trump. And Megyn Kelly says that Donald Trump only will go on Sean Hannity's program, the implication being that Sean Hannity goes easy on him and that Megyn Kelly would not. How do you look at that, David, and then Jim?
Oh, I think that she's right on the money about that. Donald Trump is not going to take questions from anybody who's competent. I mean, I've said a couple of times that if you want to see really tough questions of both candidates at the debate, have Hugh Hewitt and I ask the questions. Hugh Hewitt is a very smart conservative talk show host. And you have the two of us ask the questions, and you'll learn some real stuff about both candidates. Trump goes on Sean Hannity because Sean Hannity feeds him softballs. And having watched this, it's pretty clear there's been some advanced conversation, if not directly, then with producers about how to tee up what Donald wants to say. Megyn Kelly is a very smart questioner. She's asked some of the smartest questions that were asked in the debates. And Donald Trump knows that she will ask the question he doesn't want to deal with that could embarrass him.
Jim Tankersley, there at the Washington Post, you've talked about the difficulties in covering Trump, who is such a chameleon on his policy positions. When you guys sit around in your editorial meetings, do you talk about that as a journalistic problem to be solved?
It may surprise you to know that we don't have a centralized election coverage planning meeting every day or even most days. But we do a lot of informal discussions. You know, I work on the business in the business department of the Post, where we do a lot of the policy coverage for this campaign, and then there's the folks who are on our national desk who do the politics coverage for it. And we work together, and they've done a lot of the great investigative work over there on national, David Farenthold and the stuff on the Trump Foundation. But what we do often in my group is we talk about what are the big questions that we are seeing from this campaign, and you know, what are the difficulties of getting at it, like how do you write about the way in which the Trump tax plan would affect small business when the Trump campaign will not specify what the actual details of the small business provision are in the plan. So, yeah, we do a lot of talking about it. I do want to go back, though, to one thing that a point that I should have made at the end of the last answer, which is that when I talk to voters who are solidly for Trump, and I've done that a lot, they're not bothered nearly as much by the idea of policy details as, you know, my colleagues and I are as policy reporters. They just feel directionally like Trump is for them, and that he's speaking for them, and he's standing up for them, and they seem less interested in the idea of whether the plan balances out, because they have confidence in him personally that he's going to make it work. And that's something I hear a lot from them, and I think it's worth, you know, mentioning here on the air. That makes it, you know, part of what the challenge is both reflecting that sense that his voters feel, and also trying to nail politicians down on policy, no matter who they are, because if they win, they're going to make policy, and then the details really do matter.
Absolutely. One question to each of you now, as we just have a minute or so left. Is Donald Trump going to have to release his tax returns before Election Day? He has said all along, I'll release them when the audit is over. That, as has been widely reported, is a bogus excuse. There's nothing that prevents him from releasing it while the audit is ongoing. I'm going to put both of you on the spot here. Do you think that he will be forced to do that? Let's start with you, David K. Johnston.
We're never going to see Donald's returns. We know he paid taxes was 1977, and his own tax guy, Jack Mitnick, when Lawrence O'Donnell, I interviewed him on TV the other night, said he should release those returns. There's no reason not to. But no, we're never going to see them because they would allow us to figure out how deeply he's in bed with the billionaires around Putin, whom he keeps praising, who he's really in hock to, and it would show that he's no billionaire.
Jim Tankersley, what do you think, and how should the media be covering that question?
I mean, I think it's very unlikely, slash almost impossible, that we're going to see his full tax returns this campaign. But I would point out Richard Rubin, who covers a lot of the tax policy stuff for the Wall Street Journal and has done a fabulous job this campaign, wrote a piece this week saying, well, what about his 2015 tax return? It's not going to be under audit, and he's supposed to be filing it this month. So maybe there's some pressure on it just for him to release that 1 year of taxes because he won't have the audit excuse. I don't think anybody has their hopes too high for that, but it does seem like maybe that's more of a chance than anything else.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We have been talking about taxes in the economy in the 2016 presidential campaign, also earlier in the show, the Columbia peace deal. My guests have been Roque Plana earlier. He's the national reporter at the Huffington Post covering Latino politics and Latin American affairs. Joining us to talk about taxes in the economy have been Jim Tankersley. He covers economic policy for the Washington Post, and also frequent guest here, David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and the author most recently of The Making of Donald Trump. We will invite all of you to be joining us online here and, of course, Sunday night for the first presidential debates. And Monday's show will look at those presidential debates. Afterwards, please join us for that and give us your feedback and your thoughts about what Sunday night's debate taught you about the candidates. That's at 6 p.m. Eastern time, 6 p.m. Pacific time. I'm Mark Hertzgard. Thank you very much for joining us on Your Call Radio.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.